Hello again, everyone. It's time again for Chatter on Books. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. We are rocking through the fall very quickly. I don't know how that's happening. And in just a little bit, we're going to be talking with Barbara Kingsolver, who is a really remarkable novelist, essayist, poet, and she has some wonderful things to talk about, including this book, which is called How to Fly, and it's poetry. And David and I have a high bar for poetry, but this one is pretty amazing. A few other things on tap. A pop quiz. I did not tell our panelists tonight that we have a pop quiz, but we do. It's about something in the news today. And a chat, a little bit of a chat if we have time, about awards and competitions in the age of COVID. Are they as meaningful, as significant? But most importantly, who's joining us tonight, we have Claude, of course, making everything that's important happen. We have David Aldridge wearing his very own personal jersey. And a Chatter on Books alum, Kathleen Barber, which is just wonderful to have you back. Kathleen, how are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing as well as anybody could be doing right now, I think. But
we were just laughing before the show. David and I have developed some patterns during the pandemic that we probably shouldn't have. And you had a baby. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, it was it's my second child, but it was my first born during a pandemic. So that was a unique experience all the way around, from the pregnancy to the actual birth.
When was the actual birth and what flavor
in
did
the beginning
you have?
Of August. Ooh, I had a little girl in the beginning of August. So I always joke that she thinks that half of my face is polka dotted because I was wearing a polka dotted face mask when she was born. Yeah. And that was like the first thing that she saw.
And it was completely different than your first child's birth, I'm sure. Right?
It was.
How many in every room?
Fewer. You know, for both of them, I just had my husband, but this time it seemed as though there were a lot fewer people at the hospital coming in and out. One of the big differences was that when my first was born, my mom was in town visiting and was able to come by and see us. And my mom was in town again, but this time to watch my older child. And so she couldn't come. My older child couldn't come. He's two. So it was kind of the first time we had been away from him for a long time. But I was really concerned that spending that time away from him, not being able to see him for a couple of days, he was going to be very sad. But as soon as we came home after having the baby, I tried to say hi to him and he totally ignored me and just shouted, "Where's the baby sister?" So
I have friends who had
the novelty.
Friends who had a baby in June, and other than the doctor who was on the receiving end when the child was born, the parents are the only ones who've held the baby because of the pandemic, and they're being very, very careful. And there are older grandparents on both sides, and so they're being very uber, uber careful as they should. And I've seen the baby at a distance, right? We're allowed to pay homage at a distance, but they're the only ones that have held the baby. And we were joking about the mask, but think about what their early impressions are. Masks and shields and things like that. How many people have been allowed to hold your baby child?
A few more. So like I said, my mom came. My mom lives over in Illinois, but she drove the whole way. Uh-huh. And then my husband's sibling lives a couple of blocks from us, and we have been seeing them during the pandemic. So they were able to come over and see the baby. We've also been using a nanny for my older child. So she's also had the baby.
But all quarantine pod approved. So you have your little baby pod. Yeah. It's amazing though.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Well, that's great. It's wonderful news. And we are so glad you joined us. Okay. I have a pop quiz for you two, which is in the world of all things literature. So I'm going to give you a few names and you have to tell me what's the common theme here? What do Toni Morrison, Harper Lee, John Steinbeck, and Margaret Atwood all have in common? Do, 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 do.
Oh no, am I allowed to Google?
No, no, and we can see you on the show. They can hear you, but we can see you.
Sorry. National Book Club Award.
No, I don't think so.
No, okay.
Nope, don't think
that's
so.
That's what I got.
Okay, it's a good guess though. Good guess. Any guesses, Kathleen?
It's just going to be a stab in the dark, but are any of their works being adapted?
No, but you're all getting warmer. So they all wrote books that are among the 100 most subjected to censorship books over the past decade. The American Library Association, it is National Banned Books Week, because it's every day is something, every week is some national something or other. Mm-hmm. And they are among the books that are most commonly censored for different reasons. And there was a great story in USA Today about this. And also on the list, Dave Pilkey's Captain Underpants picture book series. Why would you possibly ban that? So here, this is from the USA Today story. A lot of the books on the list reflect a growing trend in recent years to challenge books by people of color and books from the LGBTQ community, says Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. Who else was on there? 13 Reasons Why. And they think, and they reflect in the story, a growing trend toward trying to censor books, mm-hmm. which is insane. Absolutely insane. They think that Handmaid's Tale was anti-family. I mean, I'm sorry, they thought that Hunger Games was anti-family, mm-hmm. right? Absolutely insane. To Kill a Mockingbird and a couple others are always on that list. But anyhow, mm-hmm. and we see Barbara Kingsolver. Thank you for joining us, Barbara.
Hi.
I'm so glad that you have joined us. Let me draw you into this one quick conversation I want to have with David Aldridge. Say hi to David Aldridge and to Kathleen Barber. Say hi to Barbara Kingsolver.
Hi.
One of these days, David, we have to really do one of these shows and actually have it as a Zoom show. Because I've gotten lots of emails and texts from people saying, you seem to be having so much fun talking to one another, we'd like to see it all. So one of these days, right?
Okay.
If in the time of pandemic, I can ever get a haircut. But, okay, let me raise this one topic and see what you guys think. So we were watching, my family is a total Caps fan, as David knows. And 2018, the Stanley Cup Championship was the best thing ever. This year, the Caps aren't in it, but it's the Stanley Cup Championship in the time of COVID. And it's weird, and they've been in a pod in Edmonton.
Edmonton, yes.
And it's just not the same. And I think the baseball playoffs are about to be upon us. It's just not the same. And then in your world, Kathleen and Barbara, we have the National Book Awards. We have Booker coming up. And it's not the same. And I wonder, are these awards, are these competitions as meaningful in the age of the pandemic as they would be if we just had a normal year, if there's any such thing as a normal year? David, you first.
Oh, I would defer to the authors here. I think everything is different, but in some ways they can be more meaningful. If you endure to the point where you're able to complete and finish a masterpiece in this era, when there are so many things pulling at our collective bandwidth and our individual bandwidth, if you have the discipline to mm-hmm. write something meaningful that affects people and impacts people's lives and gives them joy or makes them cry, I think that in some ways that's going to be even more meaningful than an award won in 2016 when we're all still self-centered to a degree. Just a thought. Doesn't mean I'm right.
Yeah. Kathleen, what do you think?
I mean, I think that for the people who are kind of like creating the art, the award might feel kind of strange given that there are so many other things going on in the world. But I think that the awards themselves are really important because so many of us are so isolated and cut off from other communities where we'd normally be kind of discussing and sharing art and culture. And so to kind of have these similar talking points, I think, can kind of help bring people together, which is really important right now.
Yeah. One of the things I wondered, reading about the National Book Awards coming up, and as they used to say in my kids' grade school, a self-to-text reference, because you try to make everything about yourself, in this case, about Chatter. So the National Book Awards, Hannah Depp Oliver, who runs Loyalty Books. Remember, David, we did Loyalty Books
sure.
a couple, once or twice. Yeah. Hannah Depp Oliver is one of the judges for the fiction category. And then Frank mm-hmm. Wilderson, who wrote Afro-Pessimism, is on the long list for the nonfiction. Really, really incredible book. And one of the most delightful guys. One of the most, David, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the most depressing books.
Depressing and necessary.
No, very like, necessary. You know, absolutely. Very,
like
very
every,
necessary.
Like every medical exam you get after 50.
Exactly. Exactly. Depressing and eye-opening and all these kinds of things. And one of the most delightful, upbeat, wonderful guys. He's on the long list. So our Chatter on Books fingers are crossed for him. One of the things I wonder is, in the sports world, in the age of the pandemic, everything is compressed. Seasons are shorter. And so are the wins as meaningful, those kinds of things. But in the literary world, people have more time. They have more time to read. I don't know enough to really say this is important or not, but I don't think it was an accident. In the National Book Awards, a lot of these long listers were first-time authors or first-time on the list. And maybe the judges have had more time, and maybe they've been able to reflect, Kathleen, to your point, on new authors or people addressing things in a new way. But let's bring in Barbara. What do you think? You're the pro in all this, multi-award winner.
My thoughts about awards during the pandemic, and is it weird? Well, I think, okay, for people in, for performers, for people in sports, for musicians, these are very weird times, and their award ceremonies must feel very weird. For a writer, it's the award ceremonies that are weird. I mean, look, here's my life. Like, normally, I go to work in yoga pants and socks. My commute is I get up, I go to the coffee machine, and then I go to my writing room, which is this room, and I close the door, and I'm by myself, completely alone for, 8 or 10 hours a day, year after year, and I really like it. And that's normal life. Pandemic, run the whole thing. Same.
But you trained for this. So you trained for the pandemic.
Well, I mean, I'm temperamentally, suited for it. We're professional introverts. Writers, have to be successful. We have to love isolation. So for me, an award ceremony, holy God, what am I going to wear? I have to actually, I can't go in yoga pants and socks. I have to go somewhere. I have to meet the public. It's very shocking to the system, ditto a book tour, all of these are the sort of abnormal aspects of a writer's life. I'm very grateful when it happens for the readers, for the enthusiasm and all that. But it's a very weird thing to do, to attend a ceremony, given the, normal constraints of my life. So as it happens, I have an award ceremony to attend this Saturday. And they very nicely shipped me the award itself in a wrapper, so that when, we get this presentation, the presenter will say, "And I now give you," and they hand over, and I, like, we do this little magic trick where I say, "Thank you," even though she's in wherever she is, Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and I'm here. So I read the whole script and how this is going to go, and I thought, I can do this in yoga pants and socks. This is awesome.
Yeah, I think maybe the bumper sticker of the pandemic got to be the bottom half doesn't matter.
Right.
I can wear his jersey. I can wear my t-shirt.
I'm wearing yoga pants right now.
Yoga pants. Right. But Barbara, you were wearing yoga pants before it was cool to wear yoga pants.
Exactly. Yeah. Before yoga class.
Yeah, we had Ken Follett on last week, and he said the exact same thing. Right, David? He just said, "No, my work life has not changed a bit."
Yeah,
it's
right.
Been exactly right. The same. Get up, and him, let's have a cup of tea, and then go do his work. So we're talking to Barbara Kingsolver, who has written so many wonderful books, and she has written poetry before, but she now has out How to Fly in 10,000 Easy Lessons. I'm holding it up, even though people can't see it. Which, as we were saying at the start of the show, there's a high bar for some of us when it comes to poetry. I really couldn't put it down. I could not put this one down. I started reading it. I didn't stop reading it, and we'll talk lots about it. But let's talk about you first, and let's talk about Barbara Kingsolver growing up in rural Kentucky.
Okay. Do we have to?
Well, David knows I've got an obsession with horses, and I was so struck. I can't remember which interview I was listening to, but you were talking about the thoroughbred horses. Uh-huh. Raised on bluegrass, and they were raised like royalty. And your life when you started, and tell me if I'm saying this wrong, was a little bit different than royalty. But you felt the contrast even then, right?
Well, yeah. Actually, there's a poem in this book about how I got over hating horses, because I grew up being really mad at horses. And here is why. I lived in a really rural county in Kentucky. We would go to Lexington on special occasions, like to buy school shoes or, you know, to see relatives, because there was not any store in my county where I could buy school shoes. And when we drove to Lexington, we would go past these mansions and these big fancy farms. And there was this training center that had a swimming pool. And my mom always said, that's where the very special horses get, I mean, I'm serious, a swimming pool for the horses, for their therapy or whatever. And I would just sit there in the back seat so furious, because you know what? In my whole county, we did not have a swimming pool. So I thought, great, the horses are more important than me. So I was pretty, you know, seriously pissed off at horses for, you know, like until like, I don't know, my 30s or something. But there's a poem in here about how I transcended my jealousy of horses.
You did at a derby party. So let's talk a little bit about your life. You've lived all over the world. You've lived all over the world, including the Congo.
Yeah.
How did that help in you? How did that manifest itself in your writing over the years?
Well, you know, of course, it's hard to say because there's no control group. There's no Barbara that just stayed in one place the whole time, and we can't see what writer she was. But I can tell you several things that were I know were formative. One is that I did grow up in one of the most rural, poorest parts of the country, and I grew up kind of really aware of class, the racehorses being one example, sort of just, you know, watching what happens when big capital comes up against labor, you know, because there were also the mine strikes and all that. So I grew up with kind of a class awareness. And also I had these very unusual opportunities, even though I lived in a very, very small town. Okay. Another thing I can say is that growing up in a really little town made me love books, because reading gave me my window into the rest of the world, because I was so curious, you know, what do other people do in other places? And then I had this a couple of unusual opportunities because of my dad being a physician with a kind of, you know, very developed conscience. He had a couple of opportunities to go and serve other underserved areas. I mean, where we lived was one such place. But another was the Congo, and some friends of his talked him into going to the Congo. So we lived in this village where there was no electricity or running water or cars or commerce of, you know, sort of nothing I recognized, no other white kids.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but can I ask, how old were you when your dad came to you, your parents came to you and said, we're leaving rural Kentucky and we're going to the Congo?
I was 7 years old. And I thought,
and what'd you think?
I thought, awesome, I get to skip second grade. and in fact, I did. That's nice. I generally call the Congo what I did instead of second grade. And it was a really impressive education. I lived in a place where most people had never seen white kids. So I was the white kid. I learned what it's like to really stand out and be judged for the color of your skin. To be noticed is putting it mildly, you know, people just called us the white people. And I had to get used to that. And I felt really incompetent compared with all of these African kids whom we befriended, who were really better at everything that they needed to do in their lives, like, you know, carrying water and building houses and climbing trees and getting food and all this stuff. I just felt like, you know, such a I don't know, a slug or something. Like, I wasn't really very good at anything. So, you know, cause they were like, you know, they were 8 years old and they were building houses, you know, when they were 12, they were having children. So it was just, such an education. And then I came back to rural Kentucky to a newly integrated school. And, you know, there were like two black kids in my grade. And I just, like, first day of school, I went right over and sat with them and said, I'm with you, girls.
Got it.
You're my girls. Mm-hmm. I just sort of understood, or had just a feeling of being an outsider in my own skin, real honestly, for the rest of my life. It's something that I've just carried all along. And I know that I carried that experience, and also just an interest in the Congo with me for my whole life. So yeah. that's what led me to write the Poisonwood Bible, which is not, of course, in any way about my own life, but it's informed by having lived in the place where
it's about
set.
The politics and the culture and families.
And it's also about colonial arrogance and that presumption that we in the West can just march in and tell people, you know, what's best for them. Yeah. Sort of having seen that firsthand,
is it true?
I wanted to tell that story.
Is it true that it took you 10 years to write that book? And you refer to it as the acronym DAB, which I will let you say what DAB may have stood for.
Yeah, it was the Damned Africa book. It took more than 10 years, honestly. Oof. It was probably more like 20. I started thinking about it and started collecting data, just doing research, collecting information, writing ideas, and I put them in a filing cabinet, and it grew and grew and grew. And I realized then that's when it, you know, the name, the title of the filing
D-A-B.
Cabinet was the DAB. And I understood that I was terrified of writing this book. I kept saying, well, when I'm old enough and smart enough and a lot smarter than I am now, I will try to write this book, because it was really a frightening undertaking, you know, because
can you share that? Why did that terrify you?
Oh, a lot of reasons. Writing about it's a huge story. It's about what the West did to Africa, specifically in, 1960, when the president of the United States ordered the assassination of the first democratically elected president of the Republic of Congo. Okay. So it's what we did. And it's about how the US and, the rest of the Western world has profited from the sort of all these deals with the devil that our governments mm-hmm. made in order to continue extracting the wealth of those countries and continue keeping their populations poor. The Congo is one of the wealthiest, mineral richest countries in the world, and it has the richest land and the poorest people. That's not an accident. And my country, I was a baby, I had no part of Eisenhower and the CIA and that assassination plot, but I have grown up and lived my life in a country that was very much very much enriched by that mm-hmm. those deals with the devil. So I wanted to write about how we reckon with that, how we, what is the reckoning that each of us, the kind of moral reckoning we each have to make with this. It's very much like what's going on right now with Black Lives Matter, with kind of coming to terms with the truth of the evils of our past and what we have gained from them, what many of us have gained from those evils without even acknowledging it. So that's a big one to write. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, it's set in a place that I could not go back to visit.
Right.
Because then those were the Mobutu years, and I checked in with some people who lived there, and they said, here's what will happen if you arrive in Kinshasa, you will be shot. And I said, okay, that's not going to help my book, at all. So I had I made a lot of other trips to other parts of Africa to kind of get as close as I could to get, cause I can't write about a place that I don't really completely know. And I had a child's understanding of the Congo because that's, mm-hmm. I didn't know from politics. I was, just like saying, hey, climbing trees and trying not to, encounter cobras. It was a big project and it was scary. And I kept finding reasons to postpone it another year and another year until my husband kind of called my bluff and said, okay, just start writing. When you reach a point where beyond which you cannot go, Mm-hmm. Then we'll figure out how to go to the Congo, but just start. And so I realized what was holding me back was fear, which is so often, you know, that's what writer's right. block really is. It's writer's fear. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I gave myself permission to, you know, just dive in and, yeah, but that's it. But even the writing itself took a long, long time. So right. anyway.
You talk about fear all the time. I've read several of your interviews and watched you on YouTube, and you talk about fear. A writer, a good, no, it's a good thing because yeah. I think it's true. All writers are terrified, no matter what you're writing about. You're terrified you won't get it right. You're terrified you won't be taken seriously. You're terrified that people won't be in any way moved by what you're writing. So how did you push through that?
Well, you know, I in the beginning, I'm often daunted both by my subject matter, because I never choose anything easy. You know? I don't know why. I mean, you know, you just look at what I've written about, not just, you know, colonial aggression, child abuse, climate change. It's just like not a cheerful backlist. I have to write about the things that worry me most. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I always enter a novel sort of daunted, concerned, worried, afraid. I won't bring this material, you know, sort of, I won't do my best by this material. Or I won't, you know, be able to tackle this big thing. I'm also daunted just by the novel, the form itself, the novel. Walking into a novel is like walking into a cathedral. You just look up yeah. and say, oh, sheesh.
Right.
You know, that's a big thing. You know, and so you have to have humility. If you don't bring humility to the yeah. project, then you're sunk. You know, if you go into it cocky, you're going to fail. So I think this kind of humility is really important, but it also, and I feel like it's important to stay at the edge of your powers, like feel like you're working, you're pushing yourself, mm-hmm. you're trying, you're reaching for craft challenges beyond anything you've done before, feeling excited and nervous, you know, that you're going to crash and burn, kind of keeps you, you know, awake at the wheel. But mm-hmm. it's also so important to make your peace with that. A lot of the things you listed, like worried that readers won't get it, worried that readers won't take you seriously, that I don't do. Okay. I shut this door of this room and I try to write. I mean, the only people looking over my shoulder when I'm writing are the people you can see behind me is like right. Virginia Woolf and Charles Dickens those, you know, sort of my muses, my teachers keep me honest, but I don't worry about audience when I'm writing, because you can't. I mean, that if I tried to give people what they wanted from me, first of all, I don't know what that is. It's not one thing. It's a million things. It's, you know, I would tie myself up into some kind of a stupid pretzel. I just worry about what I've got to say that's unique to my exact position in the universe, which is a pretty unusual position, because first of all, I have this unusual, you know, very rural, but also weirdly cosmopolitan background. And then I got to go to college, which almost none of my friends got to do. And I studied, well, what did I study? Biology, because, you know, yeah. I wanted to make a living. I didn't study to be a writer. So I have all that in my background too, undergraduate and graduate degrees in biology. So, you know, I think about what I have to offer, not what people want from me.
This is awesome. So, let me ask Kathleen a quick. Kathleen, you've written fewer books. Kathleen wrote "Are You Sleeping?" turned into a great Apple TV series. Can you relate to these feelings about
yeah.
walking up against, you know, the scariness of a novel? Can you relate to this? Do you yeah. have some of the same feelings?
I do. You know, I am always trying to write something new, and that's one of the things that I often come up against in the beginning, in like the idea stage. I'm like, I wonder if I am the right person to be telling yeah. a certain story, and if mm-hmm. if I'm going to be able to bring enough authenticity, because, you know, I I can only really know my own life. You know, I can read about other things, but I can only really know my own life. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of fears there. And, you know, particularly also then what Barb was saying about kind of like shutting the door and not worrying about how the work is going to be received. That's definitely something I relate to. I can start to hear critics in my ear, and I really have to work hard to shut them out, to make sure that I'm telling the story as, you know, truthfully as I can.
Yeah. I, as David knows, I always compare different worlds to different worlds. And what we've heard so often from authors, and we've just had such fabulous authors on the show, and they say at the end of the day, you have to write what is important, what is meaningful, what rings true for you. You can't write for your audiences. But David, think about athletes. What you think, what you feel doesn't matter. What matters is, did you put points on the board? Did you write? It's a much more outwardly focused outlook on life than authors. Authors have to be inwardly focused by nature of what they're doing.
True. But yeah. You still want people to like what you write.
Exactly.
I don't know many authors that go, please hate everything that I put out there.
Right. And
condemn it. No, people. Oh. I mean, it doesn't mean that they have to be. I'm not talking about a facile. I liked your book or I didn't like your book, but your book meant something to me. Is sort of important, I think, to people. Maybe not. I don't know.
No, very
well,
so.
You know.
True.
Well, no, there's some trust. I just have to trust that if I write about the things that are most important to me, and like in a universal sense, not like the argument I had about like leaving socks on the floor can be really important, you know, in the moment, but, you know, sort of reaching into your soul, into those things that, you know, finding those things that are just like burning holes in the pockets of your heart. Those, you just have to trust. I'm not the only person worried about this, you know,
right.
These big things. Mm-hmm. So you can't sweat the small stuff. You just do the best you can with the material you have. And honestly, if I worried about being liked, I wouldn't write the stuff I write about things that are hard to think about.
Yeah.
And there are always those moments when I'm in the middle of a book and I think, oh man, they're not going to follow me here. And yet they do. And I'm so grateful to readers for that. I think that, you know, it's important not to underestimate readers. I think it might, you know, if you're writing for TV, it might be, you know, easier to, you know, you might be safe to underestimate your audience. I don't know. And I shouldn't, you know, I mean, I watch TV too. I don't mean to say there's nothing good on TV, but you know what? Readers of literature, we have to trust they want to be challenged. They want to be asked questions that are uncomfortable to think about, because that's what we go to books for, wisdom and to have our worlds rocked, you know, to have our vision shifted. So, you know, you did the best, you just give it your best and trust. But I also, one more thing I wanted to say about fear is that it can be overwhelming in the beginning. It's always overwhelming. I always reach a point in the early going when I think, oh man, this is crap. You know, this is not going to work. This is horrible. I don't even want to read this, let alone, you know, anybody else. And it's daunting. And every book, it doesn't matter that I've already written, you know, 16 of them. I know that number 17 will be the same. I'll reach that point in the early going when I think, this sucks. I can't do, this is going to be bad. And you know what I do? I make this deal with myself. I get up from the computer and I walk around and I take a breath and I give myself permission to write a crummy first draft, because nobody's going to see it. Just push through to the end.
Right.
Because nobody's going to know. It will be, you know, if I die before it's done, it's going to be buried with me. That's the deal.
Right.
Nobody writes a perfect first draft. I mean, evidently Charles Dickens did, because, you know, he published his novels a chapter at a time, and they were published a chapter at, you know,
serials.
In serials. So I don't know how you did that. He had a different brain from me. He had a different deal with his, you know, with his demons. But for me, it's really important just to get it done. Write write a first draft, and then work on it. Because for me, the good stuff really happens with revision. That for me, art is really in revision. That's okay. The part I love the best.
Kathleen, quick question for you. In the writing process, what part of it along the continuum did you like the best? Have you liked the best?
I also like revising the best. Yeah. I mean, my first drafts are always very kind of like scene directions almost in a way.
Sure.
It's kind of like how I am putting the story together. And then it's going over it again and again and again is the part where I really kind of feel like it comes alive.
Okay, Barbara, before we have to lose you, I want to talk about How to Fly in 10,000 Easy Lessons.
Yeah, me too. My publicist wants you to do that too.
Exactly. Your publicist whom I love, Jane. More or less fear writing poetry than writing a novel? Or is it different fear?
It's different because poetry I write completely for myself. It is, you know, it was such an amazing discovery years ago that people would actually pay me to write novels. Wow. You know, I get to do this for a living. This is how I support my family and pay the mortgage and stuff. But poetry, nobody pays you to write poetry. As far as I know, I think, you know, even going back to Rumi, like he, you know, he also had to teach and go around giving readings, you know, even back then. So nobody really pays you to write poetry. You do that if you do, just because you can't help it, because it, it's your soul singing out loud, whatever. I've always written poetry because poems just came out of me. So,
that sounds much easy. No, I'm sure not easy, but that sounds much more enjoyable. When you're talking about writing a novel, the first thing that came to mind was fear. And when you talk about poetry, you go, it's the first thing that came to me. It sounds...
Yeah. And I don't mean to say that I'm not like dictating these from, you know, like I'm not channeling these, you know, and boom, they're there on the paper and they're perfect. I do a lot of revising too. And it's work, but it's a labor of love because I don't do it, you know, to please anybody at all. I do it just because for the love of poetry. I love reading poetry and I love writing it. And so, I kind of accumulate them without really but you know, so talking about the process, I guess the word rather than fear, I would say a novel is a lot of work. You know, it's funny because several people have asked me, you know, does it feel different writing a novel versus writing a poem? And my answer is it's the difference between a marriage and a fabulous first date.
You know, awesome.
Because a marriage, you know, you get in there and you gotta make it work. You know, you might be halfway through it and start like really not liking your characters very much, but you have to put them all in therapy and, you know, whatever. You just gotta, you know, you gotta plow through this. Not to say marriage isn't fun, but, you know, it's not fun every day. A poem, like you just like it's like a date. It's like, wow, I'm loving this and you're loving this and we're just kind of, we got a groove on here. And if you don't, you walk away and you're done. You know, you don't write that poem, but you know, it's a different kind of work. And of course I work, you know, very hard on every poem. I draft it and then sometimes I'll leave it for a few days and then come back. And sometimes I've worked years on a poem and then finally it just clicks into place. But I do it because I love to do it. And I accumulate them. You know, I really wasn't thinking about publishing a collection of poetry, but in the last 4 or 5 years, just as the world started, what do we call this? Falling apart. Can we say that?
Claude and I before the show were saying a whole new world of crazy, but yeah.
Like just when we thought we'd seen crazy, we hadn't. So I've been turning to poetry more and more as a reader because of the way it kind of quiets me down. Certain poets, I mean, it also wakes you up. It does this amazing thing that it kind of wakes up your brain and also soothes it at the same time. And so poetry has been really, really important to me as a reader in the last 5 years. And I think for that reason, you know, it's like, what goes in comes out. I
sure.
think that I've been writing more poetry as well. And about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, in a conversation with my editor, I had finished Unsheltered, and she was saying, "What's next?" And I said, "Well, you probably don't want to hear this, but you know, being a publisher and all that likes to sell books, you
likes
know,
to make money
that people buy. My editor's yeah. wonderful, but you know, how it is." I said, "You probably don't want to hear this, but I do. I would love to work on a collection of poetry." And she surprised me by saying that which she would love to do, that she'd love to publish my poetry. So that was the go, the green light. And I just dived in, and I had the best time working on this collection. And I really thought of it as a kind of relief package to offer a crazy world, because it's more, I hope it does those things we were just saying, wake up your brain and calm it sure. down at the same time. It's more spiritual maybe than a lot of what I've written before. It's more maybe, I don't know. Well, you can describe it if you
sure.
want to. I guess I shouldn't. But I thought of it as something to give people in unsettled times. And little did I know, I would be releasing it into the autumn of 2020, a year
yeah.
unlike any we've ever had. But it has turned out to be kind of just what I yeah. wanted to give the world at this moment.
Well, it's a gift, and I have to say, it's a high bar for me in poetry, and I found this. I could not put it down. Some of the poems in the book are very personal. A Fight with Your Brother by The Roots, A Broken Leg, which is called After, and some are very universal. The Forest of Antarctica. And I know people don't refer to poetry and collections of poetry as fiction versus nonfiction, but to me, this seems very autobiographical. This is so much of your life that you seem to be sharing. Was that your purpose in curating the stories that you curated?
Well, you're right. It is far more personal than anything I've ever published before. And I would say that's because I wrote it without thinking about it being published. It's what I did for myself. So now it's
sure.
kind of like imagine like you've been singing in the shower and then throw open the curtain and like there's people out there. It is a little shocking. I've had to, sort of write some cautious notes to some members of my family. Not this,
yeah.
I mean, this is not David Sedaris. It's right. like nobody's going to disown me for this, but I have kind of had a pact with friends and family that I don't ever write about personal things because I want them to remain my friends and family. Mm. But there's something about poetry it's inherently intensely personal, and without, you know, I mean, it's not like confessional or anything like that, but it's kind of plucking heartstrings, and you just have to hope that my heartstrings are your heartstrings in a different way from fiction. And so it goes a little deeper.
Yeah, the notes at the back of the book, in which you give a quick little note about each poem in the book. Sometimes they were thank you. Sometimes they were acknowledgments. Those were incredibly thoughtful. And I thought it was, David knows, I always read the forewords to books, and I always read the acknowledgments.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're from Washington, you always read the acknowledgments. Go, damn it. Am I in here? Really, that's how Washingtonians read books. They go immediately to the back and then read it through. But those were among the most delightful parts of it and made it even more meaningful, more relevant, more personal. More sharing on your part than I thought. I just found it absolutely, absolutely delightful.
Thanks. Well, now I'm feeling bad because when I recorded the audiobook, the director asked me, "Well, do you want to read the acknowledgments?" And in the audiobook,
yeah.
And I said, "Nah, nobody reads those."
Oh, you should have, because then your relatives and your friends and your force and your everything else would have absolutely loved it. Okay, let's get you out with this. And this is a version of what we call Deserted Island on Chatter on Books. And you may not answer the question, but if you go to a deserted island and you have to spend the rest of your life there alone, and you could only take one of the poems from How to Fly, in 10,000 Easy Lessons by Barbara Kingsolver, which one would you take?
Oh, I wouldn't take any of them because they're already in my head. I mean, I could recite them all. I thought you were going to, write, I thought you were going to ask me what book, other book I would, you know, as people always do. And I was, okay, I have
an answer. This is about how to fly. This is about how to fly.
Okay. I would take Where It Begins because it's the longest. It's the one poem. I mean, most of the poems are very short. They're one page long. Or just usually one page long, a few or two pages. That one is like 7 pages long. I would take that one because then I would have 7 pieces of paper I could use to start a fire for my SOS fire.
Awesome answer. Great answer. Okay, Barbara Kingsolver, it's just a delight, an absolute honor and privilege to have you with us. Encourage everybody to go out and buy. If you've never bought a book of poetry, you should buy this. If you've read Barbara Kingsolver's many, many books before, you should buy this. You should go to your local independent bookstore and buy this because that's what we'd like to do. But thank you so much for joining us. Really, just a privilege. Good luck with everything and keep writing, okay?
I promise I will in my yoga pants. And thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on. This was really fun.
Thanks so much. Take care. Okay, David and Kathleen, stay with me for a quick second. We got a little housekeeping and then a close. And the housekeeping is this. Everybody, please download us anywhere you can download us. You know, follow us everywhere. Review us on Apple iTunes. It does make a difference. Thank you very much. And next week, we are going to have on, David, you're going to have to help me here.
Okay.
Kavitha, we're going to have Kavitha and Jessica on, who have a wonderful book, which is called, remind me what it's called, David.
How to Love Sports When They Don't Love You Back.
There you go. There you go. How to Love Sports When They Don't Love You Back. Tell us about it.
I think it's a wonderful book by two sports fans who point out that it's becoming increasingly difficult to really kind of put your heart into sports when you think about all of the various issues and all of the various problems with, especially commercial big time sports, but not exclusively. If you love college football because you went to a Big Ten school or an SEC school.
Which we all should have.
And it's understandable. But, you know, with all the things that are going on in college athletics right now, with players not getting paid for their labor and all of the incredible misogyny and sexual assaults that go on in some campuses and are not at all, you know, adjudicated correctly. And talk about amateur sports and all the horrible things that we know that go on now with regard to gymnastics and other Olympic sports. It's very difficult to continue to kind of love sports. And they are writing a plea, I think, more than polemic on how you can continue to enjoy rooting for your teams and rooting for your favorite players in an era where it's increasingly difficult to do so if you have any type of conscience or morality. It's hard. So it's a wonderful book. It really is. I think you'll enjoy it.
We will love having them on the show. Thank you very much for making that happen. Sure. And we have no Deserted Island segment, no pop quiz at the end. And I'll just say this. In the last several months, I get emails, calls, texts every day from authors, many of whom I know, from publicists who want us to have authors on who've written books about politics in the current whole new world of crazy, as Claude says. And we emphatically have said no, because we just don't want to go there. And there are so many other wonderful things we can talk about. So we don't go there. So all I will say today is we're about 35 days out before the election. Everyone should go vote. If you need an absentee ballot, you got a few days left, go get your absentee ballot. I just want everybody to go vote. The more people who vote of every size, shape, color, from every walk of life, the more people who vote, the better off we all will be. So that's my public service announcement. Kathleen, thank you for joining us. David, thank you for being here as ever. Claude, thank you for making everything happen. Barbara, great to see you. Good luck with everything. And everybody, thanks for joining us. Come back next week and now go wash your hands. Bye, guys.